Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on the Upstate. This is episode 11 of the COVID Chronicles. My name is Chris Evans, and today my guest is Dr. Saria Sicosio, the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer at Prisma Health. Welcome back, Doctor.
It's great to be with you again, Chris.
Thank you for being here. We are, as I mentioned, this is episode 11. We are well into the double digits now, and I guess kind of counting, that means we're at week 11, sort of, give or take, at least in South Carolina, for the COVID emergency that we've been experiencing. And a lot has changed since we first started this. We were very forward-looking when we started this program and wondering what was going to be coming. We were getting out our crystal balls as best we could and divining what might be on the horizon. And now we can kind of look back and see what has happened and kind of catch up on the things that have taken place over the last 11 weeks.
That's right. We're seeing some changes this week. We've hit some milestones. For example, unfortunately, we've had that greater than 100,000 death
yes.
mark in the U.S. So that has been interesting and also challenging. But looking back, we've learned a tremendous amount. We've also seen where some states continue to decrease in the COVID-19 numbers, we've actually seen an increase in 20 states across the U.S. with increases in their COVID-19 cases.
And this is an interesting thing that I was looking at earlier today, because I was trying to catch up and make sure that I had recent numbers. You mentioned we've passed the 100,000 mark for deaths in the United States of America. I also noticed that we are approaching, I don't think we've quite gotten there yet as we're recording this, but we are approaching 500 deaths in South Carolina alone, which compared to the 100,000 number is not very many. I mean, it's really like our portion of that 100,000 is really tiny.
That's correct. We are seeing a relatively smaller and significantly less number of deaths in the state of South Carolina. So if you're one of those family members or know someone personally who has succumbed to COVID-19, it's still very real, of course. It does give us some perspective. And as we discuss what's changed, what do we know now versus what we had originally thought, based on the data we saw at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the CDC was reporting more of a 1.3% mortality rate or death rate from COVID-19. Interestingly, they've recently posted an adjustment based on increased testing being available and what we've learned from COVID-19. That number has been reduced to 0.04% for an overall death rate. Now, what hasn't changed are those high-risk groups that are certainly more at risk for mortality from COVID-19. So we continue to learn, and as we gather more data, it is helping us shape the future direction and how we prepare for perhaps a second peak, maybe, or even a second wave of COVID-19.
Yeah, well, and that's something that came up this week, was the not just this week, but that has been a topic of conversation this week, is a second wave or a second peak. I do want to ask about that, but I'm curious about this death rate, because it's easy to forget, now being in the middle of all of this, it's easy to forget that our knowledge base for COVID-19 is only about 6 months old, maybe. And as opposed to, say, influenza, which we've been studying in its various forms for decades, if not centuries, we're still learning a lot about this virus and how it works and how it propagates and how it affects people differently is still relatively small.
Indeed. We are continuing to learn from clinical trials of drugs, of therapies and prevention for COVID-19. What still continues, though, is the social distancing and the protection of others and yourself by wearing those face masks.
Right. Well, and that's another thing that had come up recently. My understanding about the masks is there's a lot of argument over whether the masks work and whether they don't work and things like that. And it's it's again, it's easy to try and boil this down to will wearing a mask help or not? And the answer really isn't that simple. My understanding has always been, please correct me as always if I'm wrong, doctor, because you're the one that knows more about this than I do. My understanding has always been that wearing the mask is much more helpful if you're the one that's sick than if you're the one that's healthy. It doesn't necessarily prevent you, a healthy person, from catching it. But if you're sick, it's going to prevent you from or drastically reduce the chances of you spreading the virus through those droplets that exit your body.
That's certainly true. And the masks certainly help prevent those who perhaps do have COVID-19 from infecting others. You still have some benefit, of course, to protect yourself with the mask. But at this point, it's so difficult to know who is carrying COVID-19 and who is not, as we're learning. Right. And what we've read is anywhere between 38% to 44% of the cases of transmission are from people who are not actively experiencing symptoms.
Right. Well, and then even you mentioned the high-risk groups. I suppose every little bit helps for people like that. If they, even if they don't have any symptoms of COVID-19, even if they have been tested and determined not to have the virus, a mask, I guess, could help a little bit in their case since they're so susceptible to catching it.
Yes. When I wear a mask, it's to protect those who are most vulnerable at greatest risk of dying from COVID-19.
Gotcha. Well, let's go back to the second wave fears, because that's kind of the concern right now, is that as we are starting to open things back up in the country, and that's actually one of the things that I thought was interesting in looking at the death tolls and the numbers, again, comparing the United States to South Carolina, is that states all over the union have had drastically different experiences with the coronavirus pandemic. Obviously, the places that have large cities in them, New York, California, I think New Orleans was one that had a big COVID-19 outbreak. Those places have been really inundated with the patients that we were expecting to see kind of all over, the ones that the shutdown was supposed to flatten the curve for.
Yes, it's been very interesting in our highly populated and most dense cities such as New York City or New Orleans or Miami. We have begun to see decreases in those areas. And interestingly, at the same time, we're seeing increases in other states and other communities. And one of those reasons is the access to more testing. For South Carolina specifically, we've tested approximately 100,000 South Carolinians to this point. So what does that tell us? That tells us perhaps we're picking up on the cases of individuals who are not currently symptomatic but are carrying the virus, and we're picking up those cases of patients who are truly symptomatic. We're seeing a mix in our communities. So it's very difficult to determine what are these numbers telling us. We've also heard, for example, in states such as Georgia, where they've seen literally overnight a data dump, if you will, of positive tests or recorded data into the COVID-19 results. So that perhaps could have caused an artificial spike,
right,
or a peak in Georgia. So we continue to watch the numbers. It's been fascinating to evolve and identify what these trends are telling us. And we can infer one scenario today, and as we gather more data, it's shaping our decisions for tomorrow.
It's interesting. I remember a few weeks ago, and I'm probably not going to be able to pinpoint the date off the top of my head, but I remember hearing a similar report from South Carolina, that there was one particular lab in South Carolina that had been doing these tests, these coronavirus tests, COVID-19 tests, but had not transferred that data to DHEC, and then it all came in one big lump. And so there was, as you said, an artificial spike in the numbers that made the situation look really dire. But really what it was is all of these tests had just been accumulated over, I think it was like a month. And then it was a month's worth of data that was dropped on the department all at once.
And we are seeing that occur across the country. And there is a tremendous amount of data that is being shared and inputted and disseminated. And for those reasons, we will see these injections or infusions of a bolus, if you will, of data, or a grouping of data submitted at one time. So that's why we have to look at the big picture and where are we seeing our trends take us. So again, that's something that we've been challenged with and we'll continue to see going forward as we see this, the CDC and other government officials are catching up with the data.
Bolus, that's a medical word right there that you will hear a doctor use. And I happen to know that it means lump or wad. But it's basically just a large portion of a single entity that's pushed all at once into a larger space. The interesting thing, though, is that nationally, I think our numbers are still declining. You mentioned pockets of increases around in various states or maybe even in various cities. But the numbers that I was looking at indicate that nationally, the cases, confirmed cases, are slowing their increase. The rate of increase is declining.
That is correct. And it's important to remember, while we're seeing a slowing of the cases, in the past 3 weeks, what that translates to is nearly an additional 500,000 COVID-19 cases across the country. So right. We have to keep that in perspective when we're considering a drop in the numbers. That doesn't mean it stops overnight.
Right.
And we're seeing the numbers continue to accumulate.
And that's a very good thing to remember. 1% of a million is greater than 20% of 1,000. So as that rate of increase is declining, it's still being compared to the total number of cases. And so the numbers can still be really big, but it looks, the trend is my point. The trend seems to be diminishing. And as we were talking about, this second wave that everybody's worried about, still a possibility, but it looks like numbers wise that it won't be a national phenomenon. It would probably be more like a local phenomenon that, again, if we're not careful, could get out of hand.
That's right. And in fact, what we've heard from Dr. Fauci, our most expert in infectious disease in the U.S., he has even suggested that a second wave in the fall is not an absolute. This does not have to happen if we're smart and mindful of our space and protective of those, especially who are most vulnerable.
Well, and the second wave, I wonder if have we determined yet whether COVID-19 infections have anything to do with the weather outside? I know that flu season, for example, tends to be in the fall and winter time when it's coldest outside. And I personally don't know exactly what the connection there is, if the virus just survives better in colder temperatures, or if people are more susceptible immune-wise to catching something when it's cold outside, or what it is. Maybe you can describe that for us. But I wonder if there's a similar sort of connection for COVID-19.
Well, there are many contributors that add up to a flu season. So, for example, during the fall, in the winter, we're more likely to be inside rather than outside. Mm. So you have social gatherings that are greater than being outside. Just like we're seeing with COVID-19 and the reasons why we're suggesting, if possible, to remain outside, or it's less likely to transmit if you have that space and open area. The other difference is we see that is typically when our children are in school. What's been different for this first wave is we shut down all the schools and we were able to flatten that curve. And as schools and academic institutions are determining what to do with the fall and how will they help flatten the curve, if you will, and continue to reduce the cases, those are some indicators and contributing factors that we'll have to take into consideration.
Now, this is a very interesting point, and I'm going to ask you to speculate here for a minute, because we saw the shutdown of schools happen relatively early on in this whole process, and kids were sent home and they weren't mingling at schools. One of the things that I think we've also learned, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, is that children, young people in general, under the age of about 20 or so, seem to be less susceptible to catching COVID-19 anyway. Which direction do you think that goes? Do you think they were less susceptible to it because they weren't in school, or do you think their physiology would have prevented it even if they had been in school?
Well, time will tell us
Fair
what
enough.
The true answer is, and perhaps it's a combination of both. And We care very much about our children and keeping them safe and protecting them from harm. And so for those reasons, I believe we've been less likely to put them at risk. We will be approaching a new season in the fall and considering what do we do on the front end, how do we prevent the spread of COVID-19 going forward? So it will be interesting to see. We've learned recently that there is an inflammatory syndrome seen in children, very similar to Kawasaki disease. And that has raised our concern that as we see an increase in children that are exposed to COVID-19 as an illness, we will also learn what other complications will be unique to that pediatric population.
One of the other concerns that we had early on was with testing. You've mentioned testing a little bit, I think. And early on, the concern was that we don't have enough tests for everybody to get tested, or even maybe the people that have symptoms to get tested. Since then, I mean, it's been 2 or 3 months since that point, and we've certainly upped the production of tests. What is our testing capability now? Is it any better than it was 3 months ago?
Yes, certainly we have an increase in supplies compared to before. However, it is not an endless supply of testing materials. And not only do we need the testing supplies to check to see if a patient has COVID-19, but the time that it takes our laboratories to process these tests will also be limited. So there are many factors that will go into what is most appropriate for testing. Now, we're also seeing that employers, as they're reopening their businesses, are looking for that reassurance, if you will, that their employees are safe and that they won't be infecting their co-workers. And they're hoping, I believe, to be certain that it's safe to open their business as well. Now, here's what we're suggesting from Prisma Health. We continue to follow CDC guidelines, and this is specifically in regard to the symptom screening. If you are ill, if you're experiencing a fever, sore throat, loss of taste or smell, or any of the other indicators that we've seen that are common with viral illnesses, then stay home. Do not go to work. That's the appropriate time to be tested. However, having every employee tested on that first day back to work only tells you that in that one period of time, that patient doesn't have COVID-19. So I equate it very much to, let's say, the flu test. So with the flu test, it will tell you if you've been exposed up until that day, but it doesn't mean on your way home or while you're at work, someone will begin to experience symptoms and spread that disease. Same with pregnancy. I'll use the example of the pregnancy test. You may not be pregnant today, but you could be pregnant tomorrow.
Right. That's true. There's a certain way that those kinds of things happen. Now, that brings up a question that I had, which is, how many times does a person need to be tested? I mean, we were talking about the number of resources, the tests that we have for people, and that we don't necessarily have enough to test everybody in the country. But it's possible that a particular person could consume more than one test, maybe even, you know, a dozen or so.
That's right. And currently that is the challenge for individuals who perhaps find out because they received a test for COVID-19 and they were not having any symptoms. As soon as you have that positive test, you're sent home and you're quarantined, and we want you to be safe. However, the challenge is when employers are requiring a test to return to work, this is what we know and have experienced within Prisma Health, is that in those specific situations, an individual can remain positive for the COVID-19 test days, in fact, sometimes over 30 days, though they are not symptomatic, and we have no way to prove that they're actually shedding the virus or are infectious to others. So then they get caught up in this continued cycle of repeat testing with continued positive tests, though it's likely they're no longer infectious.
Right. Well, and again, like with so many things with the COVID-19 virus, it's easy to misunderstand what the data is telling us and just kind of attempt to simplify it, oversimplify it maybe, to the point that the information doesn't mean anything anymore.
Well, exactly. And we're seeing a very interesting situation with antibody testing. Many people are going out and being antibody tested. Interestingly, some people are coming up positive that have been exposed and knew they were exposed, and others who weren't aware. And then we're also having a significant group of individuals that have tested positive for COVID-19, yet are still negative for antibodies. And furthermore, if you are positive with antibodies, there is no proof, there is no evidence that that is then protective of not getting COVID-19 in the future. It really doesn't tell us much at this point. And in fact, we're seeing up to a 30% false positive rate with antibody testing. In fact, over 20 suppliers of antibody testing have been pulled off the racks from the FDA because they have been faulty.
Wow. I didn't realize the number was that high.
It is. And I do believe we'll continue to see that rise as new companies are coming forward. And unfortunately, we have scammers out there. Just like any other time, they have identified an opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. Before we run out of time here, Dr. Secosio, I do want to mention some of the resources that Prisma Health has available. Of course, prismahealth.org/coronavirus is where you can get a lot of information about the coronavirus pandemic and Prisma Health's response to it.
Yes, and thank you. And we encourage people to continue to seek health care. And while we still have a number of individuals who are using telehealth, which works well, whether it's for chronic disease or if you're concerned that you might have COVID-19, we encourage you to use telehealth for those reasons. We have individuals who are coming back to the office, and that is wonderful, and we are there for you. As well, we want you to know that telehealth is still here, and we want to serve you in every ways to maintain your health so you can be as well as possible for you.
And of course, if you need access to that telehealth, Prisma Health has set up another website, prismahealth.org/access. And that's got information. Actually, I looked at it just earlier today. One of the first things that you see is virtual visit, how you can set up a virtual visit. You can find other ways to access Prisma Health's medical facilities. And there's even a link down there to the Prisma Health Go app that has been created specifically for telehealth reasons.
That's right. So whether you have a Prisma Health provider already or you're looking for a provider, we are certainly there to serve you, and you can find our information on the website.
We mentioned testing. Is Prisma Health still doing the drive-through testing?
We do still have our drive-through testing tent open, and we also continue to offer community testing sites throughout our communities. So stay tuned. Pay attention to the news to get those updates for the most recent sites that will be hosting testing for those who come to the site.
And of course, if you need other information about coronavirus news, you can find it at 1063WORD.com, where you can get updates on the coronavirus shutdowns, things that might not necessarily be health related, but still perfectly relevant to the COVID pandemic as it continues. Dr. Saria Secosio, the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer at Prisma Health, has been my guest today. Thank you very much for being here, Doctor.
My pleasure.
Well, and it's always my pleasure to talk to you as well. I'm Chris Evans, and this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.